Good afternoon, everybody, and I'm very happy to welcome you all here on behalf of the EU Bar Association and the Chair, David Conlon-Smith, SC, to this event on the Zalewski Judgment, Implications for Regulatory Sanctions and Impact on ECN Plus and Comreg. We are really honoured to have Judge Butler chairing today's session, and two exceptional speakers, Professor Owen Carolan SC and Michael Collins SC. And in advance of handing over to Judge Butler, I would just like to say to give our sincere thanks to all three for giving up their time to speak at today's session. We know these are three extremely busy people, so we really do appreciate it. And without further ado, I will hand over to Judge Butler to chair today's session.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. Thank you very much to the European Union Law Bar Association for inviting me to chair this webinar. I think the topic that you've chosen is an extremely interesting topic, and of course the speakers are excellent speakers. When I was appointed to the bench last October, you take office in a mixture of excitement, apprehension and regret. It is, of course, an honour to be appointed, but you do regret leaving the bar and leaving behind you, because it all, when it happens, happens very quickly. In my case, a diary that was full and full of some interesting things, including for December, the Zalewski case before the Supreme Court, in which I had appeared as counsel for the state in the High Court. And it's one of those cases which is just wonderful to appear in, because as soon as the papers reach your desk, you appreciate that this is a case raising seminal issues, going right back to your earliest days as a law student when you're trying to get your head around MacDonald and Bord na Gan. And you know that by the time this reaches the hands of Judges O'Donnell and Duchess Charlton and others, that it's going to be a seminal judgment. It's going to be a complete re-examination of the nature of the judicial power, the boundaries of that power, and I think relevant for the topics that are going to be examined today, the way in which the judicial power and the boundaries of the judicial power interact with the increasing regulation and statutory decision-making functions that we see as part of our day-to-day legal environment. And the judgments which have been delivered by the Supreme Court clearly are having a ripple effect through a numbers of areas of practice. And the speakers today are going to look, I think Owen Carolan's going to look at the topic in a broad sense, and then Michael Collins is going to narrow it down more specifically in a competition law context. And the first of our two speakers is Owen Carolan, who is, before we started, I asked to ask him, given how many titles he has, how he preferred to be addressed, because he is a professor of law in UCD, where he is an acknowledged constitutional law expert. He has written a number of important texts in the area. He's also an expert in media law. He has a background internationally in terms of both where he has studied and where he has done work and research. I also had the pleasure of, I use the word, I suppose, in inverted commas, of leading Owen in my latter years at the bar, when we did some fairly complex constitutional advisory work together, but I'm not sure who was leading who, although it was shortly before he took silk. So Owen is going to talk today on the implications of Zalewski for administrative sanctions regimes generally. Thank you, Owen.
Thank you, Judge, for your generous introduction. And thank you to the European Bar Association for the invitation to speak today. I think it's just what there is indicated. Zalewski is a very significant decision, constitutionally, administratively, across a whole range of public law areas. And that's in part because the issues are very complex. Prospectively, I think it's also in part because there are so many judgments delivered in the case. And while there is an agreed decision of the majority on the Article 37 issue, and there is a unanimous decision of the court on aspects of the Article 34 issue, the three minority judgments themselves differ in important respects. And some agree to some extent with some of the emphasis in the majority of such judgments, some disagree. So there'll be a lot, I think, there for future courts to unpack. And I think in particular, Judge McMenamin and Judge O'Donnell's judgments expressly acknowledge that and say that the approaches that they're sketching out in Zelewski are initial efforts and pragmatic efforts to deal with very complex issues that arise, but that it will be for future courts and future decisions to tease out the implications of the decision. And one thing that is worth noting in that regard, I think, from this case is that the subsequent decision that the court gave on the form of the order, because the court, while finding that the WRC was administering justice under Article 34 in this case and was saved by Article 37, declined to make declaratory orders in those terms for this express reason that they were concerned about the unanticipated consequences that would follow, potentially from making broad declaratory orders, and therefore simply declined to do so and said the judgment stood for themselves and stood on the facts of this case only, and that it would be, again, for future courts to take. So there's a lot in the judgment and a lot to work out. And what I want to do today is really just sketch out, I think, what happened, why it happened, or why it seems to have happened, and what the potential implications are for administrative bodies generally in the future. It is important just to very briefly give the facts of the case because they do provide important context. This was a claim for unfair dismissal and a claim under the Payment of Wages Act that went to the WRC under the then or the relatively new provisions of the 2015 Act, the Work Ethics Regulations Act 2015. And the manner in which it was dealt with for the WRC was agreed and accepted by all to be unsatisfactory. There was a brief hearing that lasted no more than 10 minutes, at which the parties understood an adjournment had been applied for and granted for various reasons. One of which was to allow a witness to be called and examined on the next occasion. He wasn't present before the adjudication officer on the day. When the matter came back before the WRC, the parties were informed that it had been listed in error and, in fact, the decision had already issued. And judicial review was sought. That judicial review was, it seems, conceded very early. It was indicated to Judge Meehan that by consent the order could be quashed. But the applicants wish to maintain a broader constitutional challenge to the Act, and that ultimately did proceed before the Supreme Court after a number of other hearings and stages. But I think those facts are important because those facts are so clearly in error and were so clearly regarded as unfair that they can't help, I think, but shape the court's consideration of the judgment. There's a clear sense in every single judgment, majority and minority, of a concern on the part of the courts that administrative bodies or non-judicial bodies that are exercising functions with implications for the rights of citizens must do so fairly, must do so correctly, and that has to be preserved, whether by a statute, whether by judicial review. That's an important principle. And I think the facts here provided demonstrable evidence of the kind of dangers and problems that all of the judges are trying to minimise and to avoid in future cases. So in terms of the decision, and very briefly what the decision says, in trying to distinguish the different judgments, the seven judges are unanimous that the process here before the WRC involved the administration of justice within the meaning of Article 34.1. So that is a point of agreement between all the judgments. Although, as I indicated, the subsequent decision has clarified to be on the facts of this case, not more broadly in relation to the WRC. And that meant there's a constitutional presumption under Article 34 that the functions here have to be performed by the courts. And so a key issue, and the key issue that split the court 4-3, was whether the vesting of this function in the non-judicial persons of the WRC could be saved by Article 37, which allows for limited powers and functions of judicial nature to be conferred in non-judicial bodies. And Mr. Justice O'Donnell gave the judgment of the four-judge majority, held that it could be saved by Article 37. Judges Charlton, McMenamin and McHackney gave individual dissenting judgments, as I say, with some variance in emphasis between them, as to why they thought it couldn't be saved under Article 37. It's also worth noting the court then went on, having found by the majority that it was saved by Article 37, to say there were aspects of this process that were nonetheless unconstitutional. In particular, the fact that the statute provided that the hearings had to be held in private, that was contrary to the administration of justice and the general principle of administration of justice, and the lack of an express power to call witnesses and require them to attend was again held to be inconsistent with the administration of justice. But we returned those specific aspects towards the end of the 20 minutes. So this is the Article 34 issue. This probably was the issue on which, in particular, Judge McMenamin and the majority, their differences of views probably, or their judgments, spend most time on this issue. And as everyone will be aware, McDonald and Ward-McGahn, the five-step test there has been the classic test of whether something constitutes the administration of justice or a judicial function in the meaning of Article 34. And as the majority pointed out, while there are five criteria in that case, criteria 1 to 4 essentially logically follow from the fact that a body is making a determination of legal rights and liabilities. And if it's making a final determination, that final determination is by definition enforceable and involves the criteria identified at 1 to 4. Criteria 5 in McDonald and Ward-McGahn is the one that emphasizes whether the function is something that historically has been a matter committed to the courts of the jurisdiction. And that's really, I think, a key concern for the majority here. It's the emphasis in history and on history in the McDonald test that Mr. Justice O'Donnell, given the majority, seems to be concerned about. And he, for example, compares the test in McDonald and Ward-McGahn to the tests that were used in Shannon, to the tests that were used in Lyon and Butler. And those tests were largely focused on the kind of powers of the courts identified in 1 to 4. In addition, the Lyon and Butler test refers to the power to call witnesses as having examined. And he says, the difference of McDonald and Ward-McGahn, the thing it introduces is the focus on history. And that focus on history has been assumed since McDonald and Ward-McGahn to be a key part of the test. I think in particular by reference to the Race Listers Act 1954 case, because the Race Listers Act 1954 case is, as the court said, an outlier in holding that the discipline of solicitors is something that has to be committed to the courts, and has largely been explained in the academic literature as based on history. It's something that historically was a matter for the courts, and not just would only make sense really if history is important. So the McDonald test and the focus on history has been regarded subsequently as critical. But there's a real emphasis in Mr. Justice O'Donnell's judgment on that being potentially problematic. And he identifies a major concern with it that I think is twofold. He said that it risks fossilizing the administration of justice in the form of the business of the courts in the mid-20th century. That it is a test and an emphasis that focuses on what the courts have done and not what they should be doing now or into the future. And that leads to a second concern that I think is very important in understanding where the judgment comes from. The focus on history almost creates that presumption that any novel statutory procedures are non-judicial. And that's a potential concern where novel statutory procedures can have significant implications for the rights of individuals, for the rights of citizens, and also the administration of justice. And one background contextual aspect that I think has to be borne in mind and does, I think, implicit in Judge McMenamin's judgment and also in the majority judgment, is the broader international context to these issues. There has been, and judges are well aware of this through various, the various European international networks, one of the ways in which judiciaries have been weakened in some other European countries has, notably the ones that are regarded as populist, where the judiciary is regarded as under attack, has been by the creation of parallel administrative procedures, where functions are vested in statutory bodies that are more susceptible to ministerial control and ministerial appointment. And the majority judgment and Judge McMenamin's judgment both repeatedly refer to the fact that the courts have to be conscious about future possibilities that may seem implausible now or may seem far-fetched, but are nonetheless something that might happen in the future. And that, I think, has to be seen as a reference to those kind of consideration. Judge O'Donnell's judgment frequently refers to the jurisdiction of the courts being hollowed out or whittled away by the creation of parallel procedures or the subtraction of jurisdiction. And I think that is an aspect of the court's concern with the focus solely on history. If the focus of Article 34 is solely on history, it means any new procedures effectively are presumptively outside the court. And therefore, on that issue, the majority said essentially that McDonald's test is no longer the only test, that it has to be seen alongside the tests in Shanahan and Lyman and Butler. And it really is a question of whether the court or whether the body in question is determining rights in a final way or in an authoritative way that's likely to be enforced. And in this situation, there is an administration, a determination of rights, and therefore there is an administration of justice. So that's their Article 34 issue. That then led the majority to the Article 37 issue. Is it saved by the limited exemption under Article 37? And one of the implications of the majority's approach is Article 37 is likely to become more significant. More cases and more situations and more contexts are likely to be found to come within Article 34. And that means the question of whether there are limited assumptions in Article 7 will become more significant. The majority judgment emphasises that the case on Article 37 is very limited, that it's rarely been interpreted in any detail, and that it's largely been construed as meaning modest powers. But the majority disagrees with this for a number of reasons. First of all, they say this is intended to be a saver, so it has to save something. It must apply to something that would otherwise be regarded as judicial and required to be done by the courts, i.e. a state-supported system of determining legal rights. So Article 37 has to apply to something that is significant enough that it would otherwise come under Article 34. Secondly, from an historical point of view, the majority emphasised that this was intended to capture and cover and deal with issues that arisen in the 1920s and 1930s regarding the Land Commission, the Revenue Commissioners, bodies with very significant powers for individuals and for society as a whole. And therefore, again, it's incorrect to regard Article 37 as only applying to very modest or not very far-reaching powers. And thirdly, the original case law focuses on the effects of the power. That's not very helpful. All decisions have effects, and all effects can be significant to the individuals who are involved, even ones that may seem trivial to other people. And therefore, the focus of the case in Zelewski was on the nature of the limit. And the court looked at whether there were limits on the nature of the powers that, or the limits that were imposed on the actual powers of the WRC. And they identified a number of factors here that said the WRC powers were limited in important ways. First of all, limited by subject matter. It applies only to employment rights. There's no inherent jurisdiction, there's no common law jurisdiction, there's no additional jurisdiction. It only applies to a particular field of activity. There's a limitation on the awards that can be made. There's a limitation on enforcement, given that it requires a separate application to the district court, although that itself had its own deficiencies that are discussed in the judgments. It's subject to an appeal, again, somewhat limited. And importantly, it's subject to judicial review. And a recurring theme in the majority judgment is the emphasis on the importance of judicial review. The court, in part, explains the Solicitors Act case, the 1994 case, by saying that case may have been decided differently if you were dealing with a modern system of judicial review. At the time, the public law powers were quite limited. The judiciary hadn't expanded as it had, and the court felt one of the concerns that may have influenced the Supreme Court in that case was the absence of a judicial process for reviewing potential unfairness. This emphasis on judicial review is probably the main point of disagreement with Justice Chartley's judgment. His concern is that judicial review may not be sufficient to vindicate the entitlement of a person to justice. He makes the point that a bad decision can be made by a good process, and that a person is entitled to a just and fair decision, even if it's done a bad decision by a good process. So he feels, in his judgment, and his main point of distinction from the majority is he feels if it's an Article 34 issue, there should be a right for people to go to court and have a judge determine their issues of fact and of law. But the majority make the point repeatedly that judicial review is important to protect individuals' rights. And in fact, the majority make the point that the way that Article 34 and Article 37 have been interpreted has not limited or whittled away, as they get the language used, the power of courts. In fact, in some extent, it has expanded, Judge O'Donnell says, law of empire. Because as new bodies are set for judicial review, the courts acquire powers to supervise and scrutinise bodies in areas beyond the traditional judicial function. So that's what they found in Article 37. And then finally, as I said, the last point I mentioned, even though it was saved under Article 37, there were aspects of the system that were unconstitutional as they were not in accordance with justice, the fact it wasn't public, and the fact there were no powers to call witnesses. So that's what the decision says. I wanted to just very briefly touch on some of the broader implications I think that the decision has for administrative procedures generally. Number one, it's likely, I think, to lead to a significant broadening of the scope of Article 34. More bodies, more procedures, more provisions, more processes are going to be found under this approach, it would appear, to be under Article 34. There's a clear sense in the majority judgment that new statutory provisions, that new bodies, that new powers, that new methods of doing things should not presumptively be outside Article 34. On the contrary, if they determine rights and liabilities conclusively, they should be within it. That importantly applies even if there is an appeal. The majority, so up to now, the case law and the academic textbooks have largely taken the view that you could have a process that looked a bit like the administration of justice that was given to a non-judicial person. And as long as there was an appeal to a court, that would be likely to save the constitutionality. The Supreme Court and the majority of the court are not persuaded by that. They don't say it's irrelevant. They take into account in this case there is an appeal. But they seem to take the view that it's not a silver bullet. They make the point in particular that in the WRC, for example, only 10% of cases involve an appeal, that a first instance decision is a first instance decision, can have implications, people may accept it. And it favours the wealthier party, the party of more resources, to have a system that depends upon the bringing of an appeal to be made constitutional or made fair. So the creation of a statutory appeal or an appeal to the courts is not going to be sufficient anymore to place something outside Article 34. The courts, the majority seem to be suggesting that more bodies should be presumptively within Article 34. That has a second implication, which is that the shift and the focus of this case law may shift to Article 37. Article 37 may bear the pressure of determining the constitutionality of systems in future cases. Where a system is established that allows a non-judicial person to do something involving the rights of other people, that question is going to focus on, is the power limit? And the court adopted a very pragmatic approach to that. They said it depends. You look at it in the round and say, is the power limit in various ways? The third point that's important, and this may have the most implications for how processes are actually carried out in individual cases, is what does it mean to be part of the administration of justice? And it's an important line that I think is likely to become important in future cases in the majority judgment. Mr. Sun says, what it means is the function being performed and the power being exercised must comply with the fundamental components of independence, impartiality, dispassionate application of the law, openness, and above all, fairness, which are understood to be the essence of the administration of justice. And many of those are familiar and well-established in the case law. You know, fairness, impartiality, dispassionate application of the law are things that most bodies will already be applying in terms of fair procedures. But there's two aspects there that I think are worth bearing in mind. One is openness. This is, again, a move towards increasing duties of transparency and candor on the parts of bodies that are exercising rights and obligations. And the other is independence. And again, partly perhaps by reference to some of the broader international context that I mentioned earlier on, but there's a reference in a number of the judgment, the majority judgment, to the importance of independence from ministerial control, ministerial direction, when a body is exercising one of the more limited powers. There's a concern repeatedly throughout the judgment that giving powers to statutory bodies that are not staffed by judicial persons means that you lose the constitutional guarantee of independence of action and independence of control. And Judge O'Donnell specifically references, although it wasn't raised in this case and it didn't really arise in the case, it wasn't argued, he does, of his own volition, as part of the majority judgment, point out and raise the issue that many of the adjudication officers will be people within the department of the minister, and makes comments about the importance of them nonetheless being able and feeling entitled to act independently of the minister. And that's an area where I think you may see some developments from the decision in Zalewski. The court and judge amendment talks about this as well. They are concerned, or there is a concern, that where a body is exercising these powers, they should be sufficiently independent of executive control, that the individual decisions shouldn't be subject to influence, whether directed influence in a case or a perception that the adjudication officers, whoever it might be, should be deciding cases in a particular way. Or in accordance with particular principles. So that's another thing may have implications for future process. So overall, I think the majority decision is intended to encourage and foster three forms of outcomes or it's a strategy to achieve three things. One, it's to ensure that bodies, when they're established by statute, are established in a way that is consistent with the administration of justice, that the office builds in the kind of procedural protections that should be there and are associated with the administration of justice. Second thing is to ensure that powers of these bodies are limited in important ways in their scope and function, that where you do confer rights limiting, disability limiting powers on non-judicial persons, they are limited and importantly limited. And thirdly, the court's aiming to ensure that because these are administrative disabilities, because they expand under Article 34, because these bodies are exercising powers that are judicial, or they're part of judicial function, there's no question, and there cannot be a question, but they're just subject to judicial review. So that we have a novel body exercising these kind of rights, where even where they're saved by Article 37, they nonetheless remain susceptible to scrutiny and review by the courts. And I think that is what the courts and the Supreme Court majority are aiming to achieve here. They're aiming to ensure, they're not trying, I mean, they again make the point several ways, they have no issue with, they recognise the necessity and the value and the benefit of the creation of statutory bodies, of expert bodies, of the giving of these functions to expert bodies. It's an important part of how the modern state operates. But that concern I mentioned at the outset, the concern to ensure that individuals who have their rights subject to determination by these bodies are assured of fairness, is what they're trying to achieve here. And I think they regard the way of doing that, the majority does, as you know, disagrees on this quite significantly, but they regard the way of doing that as expanding Article 34 to bring more bodies within the net of the administration of justice. But then it also expanding Article 37 to pragmatically mean that many of them are constitutionally saved in principle, in their structures, but are subject to judicial review in their individual practice and individual cases. And that, I might leave it at that point. I'm going to read any questions I'm sure to after Michael's done so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Owen. That was an extremely interesting thought, and even though I thought I knew all there was to know about the case, I certainly didn't know all there was to know about the judgments. So thank you very much for that. You mentioned at the very end about questions. I should say to those attending the webinar that there is a question and answer function. You can submit questions in writing through the question and answer function. And then at the end of the two speakers, we'll put the questions to them jointly and hopefully get something of a discussion going on the points that are of interest or of concern to those of you attending the webinar. And that brings me then to the introduction of the second speaker, Michael Collins, Senior Counsel, a speaker who almost needs no introduction. As a young barrister, it was my very good fortune to have the privilege of being led by Michael in a series of cases from Bord Pleanála. And I can remember poring over the papers and trying to distill the issues and work out what it was all about. And I would go up to Michael and explain the problem to him. And he would smile broadly at me and say, "That's O'Keefe, we win." Unfortunately, matters became more complicated, mostly through the introduction of European law, which didn't respect our Irish jurisprudence on these matters. And Michael, as it happens, went off to further and greater things and had by then become the bar's preeminent commercial and competition law practitioner, regularly appearing not just before the Superior Courts in Ireland, but before the Court of Justice and in a series of international arbitrations. And somehow in the middle of all of that, he managed to find a 2-year period where he was also the chairman of the Bar Council. As a parallel to the speech that Owen has just given, looking broadly at the implications of Zalewski, Michael's going to look more narrowly at the competition law consequences of it in a paper entitled, "Can the Requirements for Administrative Sanctions under the ECN Plus Directive Be Reconciled with Zalewski?" And I look forward to finding out the answer to that. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Judge. Fortunately, I'm not sure I know the answer to it, but I was struck by what you said at the beginning about the case law in this area being reminding us, I suppose, of our early days as students when we were studying this kind of stuff. And I had the good fortune, I remember, to study it with John Kelly in one of his last years in UCD. But it reappeared in my life in a slightly unusual situation when, in 1997, I was counsel to the McCracken Tribunal, which was investigating, among other things, the source of Charles Haughey's funds and what he had given and not given to Dunn Stores. And one of the benefits of being in that tribunal was that we got a trip out to the Cayman Islands, because the tribunal issued a letter of request to the Cayman court for an order for access to the Ansbacher bank accounts in the Cayman Islands. And the issue that came before the Cayman court was within the meaning of the Cayman statute on letters of request or letters rogatory, where are we a, quote, court or tribunal, unquote, such as we could actually issue such a request. And since the matter as to whether we were a court or tribunal was governed by Irish law, we appeared before a Jamaican judge who was sitting there. He'd been temporarily imported into Cayman because they had a shortage of judges at the time. And we had to explain to him all of the constitutional law in this area so as to try and explain that we were a court or tribunal. And as a result, he had great difficulty getting his tongue, I think, around things like MacDonald and Bord na Gan or FCK and on board Ultranish. And it was a very bizarre experience to hear these cases being debated in the sort of 40 degrees heat of a sweltering courtroom in the Cayman Islands before a Jamaican judge. So it was interesting for me to read Zalewski again or to see these cases gone back into and to think about how they might affect competition law and in particular the new ECN Plus directive that has is supposed to come into force in Ireland, is supposed to be transposed on the 1st of February 2021. It hasn't been transposed. The department is engaged in a consultation process, but there doesn't seem to have been at least any public further reaction from the department. And since then, I've no doubt they're working on it, I'm sure. It's really more than 20 years, I suppose, since the radical change was made in competition law when what we used to call the modernization regulation was introduced in Directive 1, 2003. And this was the regulation that, in a sense, changed the decentralized function of notifications and exemptions that operated in competition law previously to a sort of a self-governing, self-policing role for not only parties themselves, but for national competition authorities and for the European Commission itself. I mean, there were very good reasons as to why the authorities originally adopted the approach of keeping a system of notification and exemptions, because competition law was in its infancy and you needed to have some centralized authority that could decide when you were in compliance with what was then Article 81, paragraph subsection 3, or not. Now, Articles 101, of course, and 102. So Ian Forrester, who is now, of course, the judge of the General Court, he described the role of the competition or of the European Commission in the competition area in very characteristically colourful language, if you'll permit me to quote from him. He said, "They were keepers of a cult, fully acquainted with its higher economic mysteries. Only they could decide on difficult questions. They were based in Brussels. They'd been formed by years of study and experience. They were incorruptible and sometimes stern, and they were superior in knowledge as well as position to most of the laity. The business desiring of lightening its heart and disposing of its doubts could discern the lawful way ahead only by making a confession to higher authority, not by examination of its own conscience." So the change that came about in 2003 was in effect to make us examine our own consciences. You had to then decide whether your business arrangements were or were not in compliance with Article 101 or whether you were abusing a dominant position under Article 102. And the Commission itself got greatly increased powers under Regulation 1, 2003. They could ask oral questions during inspections. They could carry out inspections in private homes. There were increased penalties for obstructing objections. And there were provisions for periodic penalty payments for non-compliance with the orders that were made. And although it has been quite largely successful, and in particular, the number of enforcement decisions by national competition authorities has greatly increased. I think it's almost 80 to 90% of the decisions in numerical terms, if not in value terms, is accounted for by national competition authority decisions rather than the European Commission. But there have been some concerns about how national competition authorities are enforcing and are capable of enforcing competition law, both domestic competition law and EU competition law. And so in the last few years, the European Commission engaged in a consultation process trying to identify the principal areas that needed some help and reform. And that led to what's known as the ECN Plus Directive, ECN standing for European Competition Network. And the four areas that they identified as a need of attention were, first of all, the lack of competition tools, which some of the competition authorities had, such as not having proper investigative powers. Secondly, a lack of effective powers to impose deterrent fines. Thirdly, divergences in leniency programs, where a cartel member comes forward and spills the beans on the rest of the cartel and then gets some immunity from prosecution or whatever it may be. And finally, a lack of safeguards to ensure that competition authorities do act independently of government and that they have the necessary resources to carry out their tasks. And the imbalance between the different national competition authorities has created really a quite patchwork quilt of national enforcement across the EU, which the new directive is designed to remedy. And it's attempting to bring a uniformity to enforcement by imposing obligations on member states as to the type of powers and structures that they are to put in place for national competition authorities and the sort of resources that they're supposed to give them. And you can see the problems by looking in our own case at the CCPC in Ireland and the powers it has and the powers it doesn't have. I mean, it has a variety of investigatory powers. It can do dawn raids and so forth. But the key enforcement function still rests with the courts, which are, of course, designated as competition authorities under the Directive 1/2003. But it's courts which makes the declarations that there's been a breach of competition law. It's courts which grant the injunctions, which impose the fines, and ultimately, in a small number of cases, prison sentences. The CCP itself doesn't make any enforceable decisions at all that anybody's been in breach of Articles 102 or 101. I mean, it does issue what it calls enforcement decisions, but they're not really enforcement decisions in the sense that they're not self-executing, and they are merely the view of the CCPC that there has been a breach of competition law in this particular area. It can't impose any fines, it can't grant interim measures, it can't grant immunity or even leniency. It operates a leniency program, but what happens is people come to the commission, they explain their position, the commission vet the whole leniency process, but it's ultimately the Director of Public Prosecutions who takes the decision as to whether or not a prosecution should be brought, not the CCPC, even though presumably the Director acts on the advice of the CCPC. So the directive is an attempt to deal with these problems. And there are perhaps five key issues that are dealt with in the directive. And while all of them have natural justice and constitutional implications in one form or another, Zaleski is perhaps particularly important for the first one that I'm going to spend most of my time on, and that's the question of fines and who should impose fines, and in particular, whether the Competition Commission itself can and should be given the power to impose fines. But just briefly, because I'm sure I'll run out of time, to mention the other four areas. First of all, there's the question of introducing leniency programs for not only the first cartel whistleblower, but also the other people who can come along afterwards and also give valuable information, that the leniency should be extended to them. The next important topic is the standards of fining. There's a wide disparity at the moment in the sort of fines that national competition authorities impose. And the idea is that fines should be 10% of the worldwide turnover of the undertaking in question, and there should be uniformity as to how the fines are imposed. There's a whole series of minimum investigative powers that the commission, national commissions should be given, including what's sometimes called the seize and sift powers, where they can take documents and they put them in a sealed envelope and they can move off to other premises and search for more documents. And then they're only opened in the presence of representatives of the company or the undertaking concerned, or in a digital context, undertakings are given not to look at them until such time as the lawyers and so forth are there. And finally, a power to impose interim measures, particularly while investigations are ongoing. But the one, I suppose, that creates the most difficulties from a constitutional perspective is the question of both the investigation powers and the extent to which, and you touched on this, Owen, in a slightly different context, the extent to which the when you have an investigator and a decision maker as part and parcel of the same body, as is the case with the CCPC, you have to put in place procedures that strictly separate those two functions in order to comply with natural justice. And as these investigatory powers are increased and the various other powers are granted to national competition authorities, that necessity to keep separate the investigative function and the decision-making function becomes more and more acute. And it's a problem that the directive itself recognises. Article 3 of the directive emphasises the extent to which national competition authorities have to comply with the basic principles of EU law and the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the EU. So, for example, before they take a decision, they have to give what they call a statement of objections, which is basically telling you what the case against you is, give you a chance to respond, and so forth. So insofar as the fines are concerned, Article 13 is the key provision in the directive with regard to the fining power. And Article 13 provides that member states are to introduce a system of effective, proportionate and dissuasive fines, i.e. to dissuade people from breaching competition authority where there is at least an intentional or negligent breach of Article 101 or 102. And that concept of intentional or negligent breach is itself perhaps a topic worthy of discussion on another day. The member state has a discretion as to whether the national competition authority can impose the fine in its own enforcement proceedings or whether the national competition authority goes off to the court and asks the court to impose the fine. But very significantly, the directive provides that the request to the court can be made in non-criminal judicial proceedings. And that's a very significant difference from the present situation in Ireland, where fines can only be imposed by the courts in criminal proceedings, where an actual prosecution is brought, which are brought in practice mainly for cartel offences, as opposed to non-hardcore infringements. But the directive clearly provides that you can now apply to civil courts for the imposition of fines, with accordingly a lower standard of proof required, because you've got the balance of probability standard of proof to be applied rather than beyond a reasonable doubt standard, and thus facilitating, is hoped, the enforcement process. Equally, it's clearly envisaged that no longer will these sort of enforcement proceedings be confined to hardcore offences like cartel offences, but to many other offences such as abuse of a dominant position, retail price maintenance and resale price maintenance and so forth. And the critical question, I suppose, under Irish constitution law is whether or not the commission can be given the power to impose fines. Would that be regarded as the administration of justice under Article 34 of the constitution, which could then only be carried out by courts subject to the limited Article 37 exception? And I mean, I'd be interested in everybody's views on this, but it certainly seems to me reasonably clear that a decision-making process that involves a finding of an infringement of a statutory prohibition, a prohibition, the commission of which is itself a criminal offence, albeit it may not be prosecuted in the criminal context, and would result in the imposition of fines, and very serious fines, up to 10% of the worldwide turnover. That seems to me to amount to the administration of justice, particularly when you look at the Supreme Court judgments that Owen has been talking about in Zalewski. I mean, while Mr. Justice O'Donnell did say, I think it's a paragraph 123, that he didn't intend his judgment should involve any radical departure from precedent in the shape of the McDonnell test, he nonetheless clearly warns against applying the test as some sort of, as he describes it, a canonical checklist, and he expresses surprise that people have looked at it in that way. And he says that it's largely a matter of impression as to whether it's a judicial function, and there's no single infallible litmus test. But in the hypothetical case that we're talking about here, where very significant decisions would be made of this sort, it seems to me difficult to avoid the conclusion that the five criteria in McDonald, even if one was to take them as a checklist, are satisfied. Now, it does depend in part, of course, on the implementing legislation, and in particular on whether you would have to go, or the Competition Commission would have to go to court for the purpose of enforcing its own decisions. And you could argue, and this, of course, was one of the key arguments in Zelewski, that because the WRC had to go to court to enforce its decisions, that meant it wasn't the administration of justice. But the court took the view that really all the district court could do was not interfere with the actual liability finding, if I can call it that. It could simply modify the form of redress that was to be given, and that it was virtually an automatic, not quite rubber stamping, but very close to it. And therefore, the access to the court didn't save it or bring it outside the administration of justice. So the legislature could, of course, design a system whereby the CCPC's decisions would have to be evaluated and looked at by the court, and that might well take it out of the sphere of administration of justice. But that would be somewhat self-defeating. I mean, the whole point is that in a complicated area of specialized law and economics, such as competition law, you entrust that to a body like the CCPC, which has the necessary expertise, and the idea that you would then have the whole decision second-guessed again by the court would, as I say, seem somewhat self-defeating. So the question really is, and the more difficult question then is, well, is it a limited function within the meaning of Article 37? And that, of course, was one of the fault lines distinguishing the majority from the minority, as Owen has described. And Mr. Justice O'Donnell himself referred to the case being located at a difficult and indistinct frontier. But again, one could have a different view on this, as the judges of the Supreme Court did. I find it somewhat difficult to see how the proposed power given directly to the CCPC could be said to be a limited power. It's a very serious finding that would be made if you find a breach of these provisions of either the Domestic Competition Act or the later or the European provisions. And the scale of the fine is such that it's difficult to regard the function as a limited one. There are multiple authorities in EU law and other common law jurisdictions that say that the nature of the process doesn't depend on the label that's attributed to it, but you look at the consequences of the penalty and not whether it's labeled criminal or civil, to see whether what in truth is going on here is in fact an aspect of a criminal procedure. There's a Canadian Supreme Court case called Orr v. Wigglesworth, where the Canadian Supreme Court held that Section 11 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which aims to ensure fundamental fairness for any person charged with this, also applied to people who were facing what was nominally a civil fine, but which by its magnitude would appear to have been imposed for redressing a wrong due to society at large. Now, it's hard to think of a better description of what fines in competition law are intended to achieve, and where such fines are, as I say, imposed as a proportion of the undertaking's total worldwide turnover and may therefore be of staggering dimensions. So even on an ordinary view of the matter, there's certainly a big risk, to put it at its lowest, that entrusting both the decision-making function and liability and the fine to the CCPC might run foul of Article 34 without being saved by Article 37. And of course, there's also the second aspect to it as to whether or not it is in truth a criminal sanction. Because if it is a criminal sanction, then as I understand it, I defer to Owen's greater constitutional knowledge here, but it falls outside the exception in Article 37 if it's of a criminal nature. And if it is truly regarded as criminal, well, then Article 37 doesn't seem to be available. And there is jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights in relation to Article 6.1 of the Convention, guaranteeing everybody a fair trial and so forth, which has some relevance here. The Strasbourg Court has held that competition proceedings where an infringement may be established and fines may be imposed involve the determination of a criminal charge. One of the more recent cases is Muslija, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, versus Herzegovina. The United Kingdom has also, the courts have decided that penalties for breaches of what are Chapters 1 and Chapter 2 in the UK Competition Act are criminal for the purposes of Article 6 of the Convention. That's the Competition and Markets Authority v. Flynn Pharma case from 2019. And so I find it hard to see how the functions and powers, if all given to the CCPC, could rely on a safe harbor of Article 37. And finally, on this aspect of the matter, if such a fine was to be imposed or such a function was to be given, then there must be, according to the Strasbourg jurisdiction, an access to an independent tribunal exercising full jurisdiction by way of an appeal. And, of course, the interesting question is, what does full jurisdiction mean in this context? And there's the issues of both the scope of the appeal, i.e. the extent to which the reviewing court would actually look at the various aspects of the decision, and then there's the standard of review. Is it to be a limited judicial review type function, or is it a full de novo hearing? And the difficulty, of course, is that if you have a full de novo hearing, well, then you're back to the problem of you're defeating the whole purpose of the competition authority having the expertise, taking its decisions, and then finding that you come before a court and you have to engage in a full rehearing of it with all the difficult economic issues that have to be resolved. Now, there is a case from 2011 called Mernarni Diagnostics, where a pharmaceutical company was fined by the Italian Competition Authority. And the relevant appeal was in the nature of a limited judicial review. And the Strasbourg court held that that was a sufficient type of review in those circumstances. But the decision has been heavily criticised because the Strasbourg court seems to have confused the question of the scope of the review, which it said was extensive because the Italian court could look at all aspects of the decision, with the standard of review. And they don't seem to have addressed at all as to why a very limited review could cope with issues such as market definition or abuse of dominance and so forth. And in any event, that case appears to have been implicitly at least overruled by the Grand Chamber in Ramos in Portugal in 2018, a case which was admittedly concerned with the civil limb of Article 6.1 rather than the criminal limb, and was concerned with disciplinary sanctions imposed on a Portuguese judge, as it happened, by an administrative non-judicial authority. In England, in the Court of Appeal in the Flynn and Pfizer case I mentioned, Lord Justice Green held that full jurisdiction must constitute an in-depth review of the law and the facts, and so seems to have turned their face against deferential review. I'm conscious of the time, so I think I'll probably finish there so as we leave some time perhaps for questions. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. At the moment, there is in fact only one question which has arrived, but it is a very interesting question, I think, and asks whether a body administering justice, should the body administering justice take steps to notify the public of forthcoming hearings, or is it sufficient that the parties are informed in advance that the hearing will be in public? This may link in with one of the criteria that Owen thought was interesting in terms of openness. Is it enough that the parties are told the hearing is in public, or do the public have to be told the hearing is going on?
Do you want to take that one, Owen?
I can certainly offer a view. I would have thought, once you're within Article 34 and you're administering justice, you then would be bound by all of the case law from Irish times and Ireland onwards, in terms of what the in public means. And what the in public means, or that's been held to mean by the Supreme Court, is that members of the public and the media are aware of and able to report on it. And Judge Donald makes the point in the judgment, in discussing this point, that doesn't mean there aren't exceptions in appropriate cases. It doesn't mean that you can't, in some cases, say this one should be held in private for particular reasons, or the party should be anonymised, there should be reporting restrictions in particular cases, whatever it might be. But as a general principle, you can't. And the problem is you'll receive if they held all the matters in private. And I think as a general approach, if an interested member of the public wanted to see what was going on and wanted to scrutinise and had no way of finding out what was happening with the body, I think that would be problematic. I mean, I think something as straightforward as having a listing on the website of what's on a particular day would probably be sufficient. I mean, that's equivalent to the legal diary. But I don't think it would be sufficient to simply notify the parties and have no way of anyone outside that finding out. I think that would be risky.
Yeah, because the question is premised, if I heard it correctly, on the assumption that it is the administration of justice. And so if it is the administration of justice, then it seems pretty clear that it has to be, at least in an Irish context, held in public. And a point I think Owen, you made, reflecting what Judge O'Donnell made, is that even an Article 37 exception, it's a limited exception to the administration of justice, but it presupposes that even if you're within Article 37, it's still the administration of justice, and you still therefore have to comply with all of those requirements.
So perhaps that's a particularly interesting question, because it looks like it may have implications for all sorts of bodies in terms of the publication of their work schedule that may not be part of their current practices. We don't seem to have received any other question in from the attendees, but there's one question, if I can put it, and one of the things I've learned being a judge for the last 6 months is that when I put a question, people have to answer it, is perhaps listening to what Michael was saying, the extent to which Article 29 might play a role in the matters you've been considering, because we've been looking at regime changes that are required by European law, although not generally, the European directives don't generally specify what national bodies are to have what functions. But is there a role for an interaction between Article 37 and Article 29, or is that the very notion of local and limited, does it exclude the type of things that would come within European law in that context?
Yes, it's a very good question. And I suppose the extent to which some of the provisions in the directive are mandatory provisions, in the sense that every member state has to apply and provide for things like, let us say, the particular form of the leniency programs that's required, on the uniformity and fining standards and things like that, that obviously simply has to be done irrespective of what might otherwise be the approach adopted under the Irish Constitution. On the other hand, the one I've been talking about in particular, and the question of the imposition of a fine, that's not mandatory in the sense that the Article 13 gives member states a choice in terms of which system they're going to adopt. Are they going to give it to the competition authority, or are they going to give it to make them go to courts? And they're clearly conscious of the fact that there are some jurisdictions, Ireland is one, where at present this is all done through criminal prosecutions, and they even preserve, and just as I'm speaking, I'm kind of looking for a copy of the directive, which I just can't find, but somewhere at the end of Article 13, it says something along the lines of that nothing in the directive interferes with the ability of member states to still proceed by way of criminal prosecutions and so on in relation to competition offences. So when there is that discretion there, I think the Article 34 and 37 jurisprudence, it becomes the dominant consideration, and we then have to abide by that. And I think it's only in the much more limited cases where little or no discretion is given to the member state as to what they have to do in the implementation of the directive that the Article 34 considerations might fall away.
Okay, there's another question has come in. It is quite specific to the Zaluski context, so maybe a question for Owen, and asks, will more claims be settled because of the requirement of hearings in public? The concern is that employers may be more keen to settle claims if the hearing is in public.
That was touched on in the decision. It had been argued, I think, on behalf of the attorney or the state in the case, that the approach the majority were contemplating ultimately took would be problematic because it would interfere with some of the good policy reasons why you would have this process. And the court said two things. Said, well, first of all, we don't know if that's the case, but also they said, you know, there's no particular. I mean, mediation occurs in a judicial in a court context. Pre-trial settlements occur in a court context. The fact that something is the administration of justice is not, in and of itself, any reason not to encourage those kinds of pre-hearing systems and be very good public policy reasons for them. So, I mean, the question is an empirical one. I suspect it's possibly true. I mean, it may equally go the other way. I mean, maybe employees will also be less willing to have their names dealt with in public with allegations against them. So, I mean, it might encourage both parties to settle things in advance. But that didn't, if that is what is going to occur, that didn't seem to discourage the Supreme Court from taking the approach that they took in the case.
I don't think we have any more questions coming in. So I think that probably brings us to the end of proceedings. So can I thank both of the speakers? And certainly I have enjoyed the webinar very much and found it very educational and enlightening, and I'm sure those attending have found it equally so. And on that basis, I can thank the speakers again and pass you back to Suzanne.
Thank you very much, Judge Butler. And indeed, thanks so much to Owen and to Michael, and very much to Judge Butler also for this really interesting session. And a special thanks, I think, to Michael for whisking us away to the Cayman Islands, which we all needed. But also now we're very jealous of your very glamorous practice. So but thanks for that. And indeed, thanks on behalf of David Conlon Smith as chair of EU Bar Association, and we look forward to welcoming you at our